This is The Pulse, stories about the people and places at the heart of health and science. I'm Maiken Scott. This story is from our episode about exposures. You can find us wherever you get your podcasts. On the night of February 3rd, 2023, Zhuzha, Jenis, and her 9-year-old son were up late making crafts in their apartment in East Palestine, Ohio, right by the Pennsylvania border. Around 9, they noticed there was a fire down the road, so they stepped outside into the frigid night to check things out.
And then we saw, like, these huge flames, like, hundreds of feet tall, and I was like, this is bad.
They hurried back inside and watched from the window as sirens blared through the night.
It was really crazy, and my son, he's 9, he loves fire engines, police cars, so all that stuff. So he was, like, reenacting it with his toys and was, like, running back and forth to the window, you know, counting up all, like, the undercover cop cars and all this crazy stuff. And he's like, this is exciting, but it's scary at the same time.
Thankfully, her son finally fell asleep. But Zhuzha stayed up, texting with neighbors, trying to figure out what was going on.
Everyone's like, did you just hear that explosion? Because it was constantly exploding. There was these flames, like just, and they would go up and they would get it down, and then it would restart in these explosions, these booms, and everyone's just like freaking out, like, what do we do? Like, what's going on? And nobody had any information.
Then, around 3 in the morning, she heard a strange, loud noise coming from her son's room. She got up, rushed into his room, and a powerful smell hit her right away. It smelled like bleach.
And he, my son, is, you know, up in his bed coughing, vomiting, like projectile vomiting, shaking. He's gasping for air, begging for water.
Zhuzha was terrified. And whatever this smell was, she was starting to react to it as well.
You immediately get this film on your mouth and your tongue, just breathing in there. Like, you know there's something in there, and your body's telling you. It was like a huge warning sign, and he's obviously sick. Wasn't sick before, and, you know, I thought it was in my head until within a few minutes. That's all it took. And then, you know, I was like, we gotta go.
She grabbed a bag, and they hopped in the car and drove 20 miles east to a hotel in Chippewa, Pennsylvania, near her son's grandmother.
And we get there, like, 5 in the morning. He finally, like, gets to sleep, and he throws up, like, one more time, and then he just passes out.
By that morning, the incident was all over the news. A Norfolk Southern freight train had derailed near Zhuzha's house, leaving a smoldering tangle of 38 cars along the tracks. And the explosions they heard, the smell, the sickness and vomiting, that was just the beginning for Zhuzha and many of her neighbors, who would soon find out that they had been exposed to hazardous chemicals. In the days after the derailment, officials made a decision that was supposed to protect residents from further explosions. But this decision backfired and exposed them to even more hazardous chemicals. Hundreds of people living in and around East Palestine have since reported symptoms like headaches, coughs, and rashes. And the long-term effects could be even more severe. Reporter Julie Grant has been following this story since the derailment happened 2 years ago, and she picks it up from here.
When Zhuzha Jenis' son woke up the morning after the derailment in the hotel room 20 miles away from their home, he seemed fine, back to his normal self.
But he started developing these rashes on his arms, which was weird because he hadn't been in contact with anything like that.
Over the weekend, they spent time with his grandmother, Zhuzha anxiously keeping an eye out for new information on the disaster that had struck their community. On Monday, Ohio Governor Mike DeWine and other public officials held a live-streamed press conference where he explained what was about to happen.
Ohio Governor Mike DeWine and Pennsylvania Governor Josh Shapiro are ordering an immediate evacuation in a 1-mile by 2-mile area surrounding East Palestine, which includes both Ohio and Pennsylvania.
That afternoon, they planned to vent more than 1 million pounds of vinyl chloride from 5 of the rail cars and purposely burn it. Otherwise, they worried it could explode. Vinyl chloride is usually shipped as a liquid under high pressure. Governor DeWine pointed to a map, a red circle around the area closest to the derailment site. That's where Zhuzha's East Palestine apartment was.
Those in the red area are facing grave danger of death.
Zhuzha was still 20 miles away. Shortly after the chemical burn in East Palestine had been executed, she was leaving her son's grandmother's house to head back to her hotel room.
I stepped outside and it was literally like a black wall, like in the middle of her street. It looked like fog, but very, very dark. It was black, but it wasn't like hovering up high or anything. It was like a whole wall. And I turned around, right, went back in, and she's immune compromised, has health issues too. And I said, we have to go. Like, we all have to go. And she went outside and her face just turned white and we left. We all left.
As they drove further away, Zhuzhe thought government officials would expand the evacuation zone to where she and her family had been staying, but they didn't.
So I'm like, how is this safe?
They rushed to get further away, and they never really returned, at least not to live. I caught up with Zhuzhe later that year, the fall after the derailment. She told me that since those initial exposures, she'd been having menstrual issues and her son had unexplained rashes.
It was like 2 or 3 months later, he started getting these splotches on his face, like only on his face. And they would show up and last for like maybe anywhere from 20 minutes to an hour, and then they would go away. And none of his specialists can, you know, tell us what it is or what's causing it.
It's all been a lot for Zhuzhe herself to understand, so it's been really hard to figure out how to talk with her son about it, to help him make sense of what's happened, why he had to leave his home and school.
How is this shaping a child's viewpoint of what the world is and what it means to be good, or what it means to find justice or, you know, safety even? Who can he trust?
That's a tough question, and a fair one. The disastrous incident, and especially the controlled release of vinyl chloride in the aftermath, came under intense scrutiny in the weeks and months after. The National Transportation Safety Board, an independent governmental agency, held a series of investigative hearings. Jennifer Homendy, the agency's chair, was asked about their findings during a Senate committee hearing, and her testimony was kind of a bombshell. The National Transportation Safety Board had found that the vent and burn of vinyl chloride from those rail cars was not necessary. Norfolk Southern, the rail company, was pushing for the vent and burn. It claimed that temperatures in the cars were increasing and that the tankers could undergo a chemical reaction called polymerization and explode. But Vice President J.D. Vance, at the time senator for Ohio, confirmed with Jennifer Homendy that OxyVinyls, the company that owned the vinyl chloride, found that the temperatures had actually decreased.
Is it true that the chemical shipper OxyVinyls concluded that the reported and stabilized tank car temperatures were too low for a runaway chemical reaction, meaning the sort of thing that would lead to an uncontrolled explosion?
That's correct. They had testified that polymerization was not occurring. In order for polymerization to occur, which was the Norfolk Southern and the contractor's justification for the vent and burn, you would have to have rapidly increasing temperatures and some sort of infusion of oxygen, neither of which occurred.
She then testified that Norfolk Southern did not share this information with decision makers. Instead, it gave them 13 minutes to decide whether to approve the vent and burn operation or face a possible uncontrolled explosion.
So OxyVinyls was on scene providing information to Norfolk Southern's contractor, who was in the room when advice was given to the governor of Ohio, to the incident commander. They were not given full information because no one was told OxyVinyl was on scene. They were left out of the room. The incident commander didn't even know they existed. Neither did the governor. So they were provided incomplete information to make a decision.
She testified that Norfolk Southern could have waited and allowed the rail cars to continue to cool down, instead of pushing to vent and burn the vinyl chloride, which released over 1 million pounds of it into the surrounding area. When the evacuation order was lifted a couple of days after the vent and burn, residents returned to find ash and soot around their homes and yards, on their cars, and on playground equipment, and many showed up at their doctor's offices. Gretchen Nickel, chief medical officer at East Liverpool City Hospital, about 20 miles south of East Palestine, started seeing patients with physical ailments that could be from chemical exposures.
So when I have patients that say, I've got a skin rash, I've got dermatitis, I'm having a hard time breathing, I'm diagnosing them with a pneumonitis, eyes, ears, throat irritation.
This is her speaking at a workshop held by the National Academies of Sciences in late 2023. She says she wasn't sure what to tell patients.
And knowing that we had VOCs and vinyl chloride, what, if any, kind of testing should we be doing?
Many health providers were asking that same question, whether they should do urine and blood testing for residents exposed to chemicals in the derailment. The Pennsylvania Department of Health offered a webinar for medical providers a few weeks after the vent and burn. Mike Lynch, medical director for the Pittsburgh Poison Center, told area doctors that tests checking for chemicals in patients' blood were not reliable, not clinically useful, and not recommended.
So yes, with confidence, you can tell them that there is not a chemical test that they should be seeking either from you or elsewhere at this time that can help prove or disprove exposure or would help with diagnosis, treatment, or prognosis from any of these potential exposures.
The Centers for Disease Control agreed with this advice for local healthcare providers. Treat the patient's symptoms, don't pursue testing for chemical exposures. The CDC's Agency for Toxic Substances and Disease Registry did do an assessment of chemical exposures. That's called an ACE survey of residents' symptoms after the incident. While they walked around the community knocking on doors, their own agents got sick and had to leave the area. Months later, residents filled the pews of a church in East Palestine to hear what the survey of 700 Ohio and Pennsylvania residents had found. Jill Schugert, a CDC director, explained the results.
They had headaches, coughing, difficulty breathing, stuffy nose or sinus congestion, and burning nose or throat.
One mother in the pews said her daughter was still vomiting daily since the derailment. She and other concerned residents had results of urine testing that showed markers for vinyl chloride in their bodies, and they had questions. CDC toxicologist Arthur Chang told them those tests are often incorrect. Instead of blood or urine sampling, he advised them to carefully track their health with a medical provider in case they develop cancer. Vinyl chloride is a known human carcinogen that can increase the risk of developing certain liver cancers.
So that's the reason why we're saying go to your doctor so that you can get examined. We know how to treat angiosarcoma. We may not know how to get rid of vinyl chloride from the body, but we know how to treat those cancers.
Zhuzhe Jenis was there for the meeting, and she couldn't believe what the CDC toxicologist was saying.
My jaw dropped.
She had already moved away from East Palestine, but brought the results of her 9-year-old son's urine test to this meeting. It showed the markers for vinyl chloride.
I looked around the room. I was like, did I just hear that right? And literally, they came in and said these ACE surveys showed that you guys are sick, and yeah, the symptoms match chemical exposure, and then we're just not doing anything about it.
The CDC apologized to residents for what they were experiencing and said there was no treatment to remove chemicals from people's bodies and nothing they could do. Since then, researchers have stepped in with a variety of studies, for example, looking at the movement of chemicals that contaminated local streams to see if they're making their way through the soil into people's drinking water wells. Julianne Beyer is one of at least 10 researchers really digging into the exposures from the derailment and its aftermath. She's been interested in the connection between chemicals in the environment and health for a long time. It started when she was growing up in rural Germany on a street with 20 or so homes.
15 or so of the people that lived there developed gastric tumors, some pancreatic tumors, some liver tumors, and some stomach cancer. And I always thought that must be something in the water. It was just so weird that there was this cluster of gastric cancers. And so, I don't know, I've been always thinking about it.
And later, as a medical researcher at the University of Louisville in Kentucky, she learned about a case in the 1970s. A cluster of workers at a nearby chemical plant had developed liver abnormalities. Some workers had been sent into reactors where vinyl chloride was being made into polyvinyl chloride, or PVC.
So they were exposed to these really, really high concentrations. They actually passed out within those tanks.
Federal safety standards for vinyl chloride were quickly created, and it was considered a seminal event in occupational toxicology. Decades later, in 2010, Julianne joined researchers working on biosamples collected at rubber plants in Kentucky. They detected a specific form of liver disease in those samples linked to vinyl chloride exposure. More recently, Julianne's team has been looking not at those very high occupational exposures to vinyl chloride, but at the impact of lower-level environmental exposures to it and the connection with liver disease. For example, her team tested mice by dosing them with vinyl chloride in amounts currently considered safe in the U.S., and all of those mice developed tumors.
80% of those cases were hepatocellular carcinoma. HCC, that's the major malignant liver cancer.
Safety limits for vinyl chloride have not been updated since they were first created. Even though its use is growing, it's estimated that 36 million pounds of vinyl chloride is being transported on U.S. railways at any given moment, moving along on tracks that pass through densely populated residential areas and small towns like East Palestine. Now, Julianne's team is collecting blood and urine samples from about 300 people in East Palestine and testing their liver function. They're also sampling the air and water, both indoors and outdoors, to see if residents are still being exposed to vinyl chloride.
So if there are homes that with higher concentrations of chemicals in the air or water, we predict that these residents will also have or may progress faster in their liver disease.
Of course, they hope people don't develop liver cancer. But she wants more attention on the health impacts of chemicals like vinyl chloride and updated safety standards.
I've been fighting for this to be recognized for years, actually, in the liver field, because this is not what medical students learn. They don't learn this in medical school. And most of the physicians that I speak to, they have no idea what to do. If somebody that thinks that their liver disease comes from environmental exposures, they don't know what to look for. And I think we need to figure this out.
In December, the U.S. EPA designated vinyl chloride as a high-priority chemical for risk evaluation, which could lead to tougher safety standards. After the derailment in East Palestine, members of Congress were quick to condemn Norfolk Southern and the rail industry and introduced a rail safety bill, but that stalled and did not get approved. Many people in the community joined a class action lawsuit against Norfolk Southern, and a settlement was approved by the court last fall. Zsuzsa Jenness could get up to $70,000, but she expects much of that money will be used to pay off months of hotel bills after the derailment. Zsuzsa has rented a house in another town, and her son is settled in a new school, but they still have health issues like his unexplained rashes. She worries about what their exposures will mean for their health in the future.
Because, like, I don't want to spend the rest of my life wondering what if, or, like, next, you know, I show up with a rash all over my back, you know, what is this from? Is this from the derailment? Like, we all have to ask ourselves that the rest of our lives every single day.
That story was reported by Julie Grant. She's a reporter with the Allegheny Front, a public radio program and podcast covering the environment in western Pennsylvania. East Palestine and Norfolk Southern have just announced a $22 million settlement to resolve all claims related to the derailment. Since the accident, the railroad company has already invested over $13 million into infrastructure and other improvements in East Palestine.